and welcome to the Pro Football Weekly Podcast. I'm your host, Arthur Arkus, joined here by my co-host, Nate Atkins. We've got John Solly and Dan Mott behind the board, making us sound all crystal clear as we come to you, our podcast listeners. And it's our great pleasure to be back after a week away. We got a lot of fun stuff on the show this week. We're going to meet up with Hub Arkus here shortly. Hub's down in Boca for the owners' meetings. He's going to get us up to speed on some rule changes and all the other goings-ons down there. We'll also talk a little bit more about free agency because it's been a week away, and we have some more thoughts for you on what's been going down in a crazy free agency period. So, Nate, how goes it, my friend?
Goes pretty well. I'm a little jealous of Hub right now, getting to enjoy Florida down there, so I'm sure I'll rub that in when we call him, but it's been fun just to kind of hear it from where we are as well.
Yeah, we're just pleased to have someone down there for sure. And on that note, I think we're going to go ahead and bring Hub in. Hub, Nate wants to know how the weather is, and after that, we want to know what's cooking down at the NFL owners' meetings down in Boca.
Yeah, I'd report on the weather, guys. I've been outside since I got here Sunday night, so it's Florida. It's nice. Actually, it was surprisingly chilly by Florida standards on Monday. In the low to mid 60s, and literally been, right now since about 5 or 6 this morning, but I think it's gotten up to the low 70s, and it's a fun event. You've got all the coaches, all the general managers, all the owners, and there's a lot of access. You can learn a lot, but it's also kind of a relaxed atmosphere that you're not used to seeing all these folks in, so it certainly is a change of pace from anything you do at the Super Bowl or anything like that.
Very cool. That's always nice to get these guys in a relaxed atmosphere. It's not something we see on a day-to-day basis during the season. So definitely good to hear. Hub, a lot of big news coming out of the owners' meetings, as there always is. I think the area that a lot of people are focused on are the rule changes. The Compensation Committee and the owners proposed 19 rule changes for the 2016 season. So far, 7 of them have been approved. Can you just kind of fill us in on what you think are the big ones, if any, and kind of what the talk is down there regarding some of these changes?
Yeah, I'm not sure if there's any big ones. They made the change in the extra point coming from the 15-yard line permanent now, and of course teams can return missed extra points for 2 points. They eliminated the chop block. I'm not thrilled about that one because they did not eliminate blocking below the waist. They just eliminated the chop block, and I actually visited with John Harbaugh on Tuesday morning, and he was animated. It was like he was a political candidate stating his case for why he thought it was a bad idea and believes that eliminating the specific chop block that they did, because they had already eliminated some forms of it, and by eliminating this last piece, he believes it's going to kill the zone blocking, zone read type offensive run game that a lot of teams have gone to, bring back a lot of power football and create a lot more violent collisions and make the game actually more dangerous, not safer. But obviously, he got outvoted on that one. They have not yet, as we talk, now there will be more rules considered in the next day or two, or next day, I should say. They have not yet approved the automatic ejection for 2 unsportsmanlike conduct penalties, but that one was badly misunderstood by a lot of people because it turns out the only unsportsmanlike conduct that they're talking about with this change would be anybody who throws a punch or kicks or throws a forearm. It would be anybody taunting or baiting the other team or anyone speaking inappropriately to officials. And I actually, after we had a press conference with Rich McKay, who's the chair of the competition committee, and Dean Blandino, who's the head of NFL officiating. After the press conference was over, there was something Blandino said that kind of knocked me back a little. So I went up to him afterwards just to confirm it. And it turns out that in the entire 2015 season, only one player would have been ejected under this new rule. And that was Brian Arakpo for a game that the Titans had against the Saints. So, to make a rule change that's going to affect one player over the course of an entire season doesn't seem to make a lot of sense. And what I think is particularly frustrating from a fan's perspective is it's not doing anything about making the game safer, about some of the scary and disappointing things that we saw last year from players like, Odell Beckham Jr. and Josh Norman and Vontaze Burfict. None of what they did is impacted by this potential change. And then the other rule change that is not being considered, that a lot of people are surprised by down here, is they're not going to do anything about the catch rule. The league is taking the position that the rule is fine the way it is, that they have to do a better job of educating with video so that media and fans understand what the rule is. I understand what the rule is, and it's got some ambiguity in it, but the league is saying no, so there won't be any changes to that this year.
Yeah, Hub, I'm definitely intrigued by the rule about the ejections. I think that's the one that caught everyone's eye the most when we just heard the proposals. But it's interesting to hear that only one guy would have actually been kicked out of a game for that last year. I think when everyone heard about that, obviously, like you mentioned, you're thinking about Odell Beckham Jr. and Josh Norman. Can you explain for us a little bit why would their conduct not have fallen under the criteria they outlined? Why would they not have been ejected from that game?
Well, there's two different answers, Nate. There's the technical or literal answer, which is that under the conduct that they're outlining, personal fouls are not unsportsmanlike conduct. And the three fouls that Vontaze Burfict got, the three that Beckham Jr. got, were personal fouls. They weren't unsportsmanlike conduct. I think the better question is the one that I asked Blandino in the press conference, which is, well, why not consider automatic ejection for two personal fouls in a game? And his response, which was fair, is that they believe that the plays are so bang-bang in nature that it's impossible sometimes for the official to tell, A, if there was any intent, and B, if they even got it right. Now, this is another one that John Harbaugh was adamant about talking to him this morning. Many of the coaches would like to see replay expanded to personal fouls, various penalties. Bill Belichick would like to see it expanded to all calls. Now, Mike Tomlin, on the other hand, thinks that we have too much instant replay, he told me this morning. He said he's a traditionalist, he doesn't need instant replay, so it's not unanimous. But at the end of the day, Blandino's explanation from the official's point of view is that, and he reminded us again, the officials have the authority to throw any player out at any time for anything. So it's not like they can't be punished with an ejection for a blatantly violent hit. But as far as an automatic ejection, they don't want to make it automatic because basically Blandino is admitting that they don't always get it right on these personal fouls.
We're visiting with Hub Arkish, the director of football content at ProFootballWeekly.com. He's down at the owners' meetings in Florida, kind of getting us up to speed on some of the big rule changes that have been approved this week. A couple of the other ones we didn't discuss as much, the expansion of the horse collar penalty, which will prohibit players from even grabbing the jersey nameplate. So going to be a little less leniency with regard to what is a horse collar moving forward. And Hub, just one follow-up on the catch rule, because we were both down at the Combine last month hearing all the coaches kind of not so thrilled with where the murkiness in the interpretation of that rule has gone in the past couple of years. What's the response been that you've been able to gather regarding this being completely overlooked, the NFL kind of staying status quo with this?
The coaches I talked to today weren't thrilled about it. They still believe, that, as I just said a few minutes ago, that there's ambiguity in the rule. They think that they probably could do a better job with it. It's not a hot-button topic with most of these coaches. They've kind of gotten used to it. It's not really that hard to understand the language of the rule the way it's written if you study it, and obviously these coaches have. It's part of their job. The problem is that the language of the rule creates a gray area. It's not cut and dried. This is a catch, and this is not. The way Blandino, and again, he's the head, Dean Blandino, is the head of officiating for the National Football League, the way he explains it, Rich McKay, the head of the competition committee, explained it the same way, is that you look at it in three phases. One is the catch. Do you catch and possess the football? Two, you get 2 feet down. You take 2 feet, and then they're calling the third issue time, because what they're saying is that if you catch the ball, get 2 feet down, and establish yourself as a runner, make a football play, whether it's throwing a stiff arm or lowering your head and trying to knock somebody away, those all automatically make it a catch. The problem is that when a receiver, A, catches the ball, B, gets 2 feet down, and then goes to the ground, does he hold the ball through going to the ground? Does he hold it on long enough to call it a catch? And that's the one where there is still so much uncertainty, depending on who the official is at the time, as to how they're going to call it. And, you'd think there'd be a better way. And what's particularly troubling to some, although not all, is that there's a terrible inconsistency in that rule, which is that on a running play, the ground cannot cause a fumble. But on a catch, the ground can cause an incompletion, which in effect is not a fumble, but it's the same thing, the ball coming loose. Now, the official's explanation is that the reason for that is because the player has not become a runner. Once the player has become a runner, if he's caught the ball and then he goes down and the ground causes a fumble, then they're saying that the ground can't cause the fumble or the incompletion, but that's where some of the ambiguity comes in here, and that's where it could create some of the frustration.
So getting beyond the rule changes, we'll just take a couple more minutes here quickly with Hub. What are the other hot-button issues? I'm sure that the CTE revelation of the NFL's knowing the link between football and potential brain trauma that came up last week has been talked about a lot. Am I right about that? What's kind of been your feel from talking to guys on that? And then one or two other big issues that seem to be popping up that you've got your finger on the pulse of.
Well, this gets into the closed portion of the meetings. We're speaking on Tuesday. We're going to get to visit with Roger Goodell as the meetings close on Wednesday. And then we will, I'm sure, get a statement relative to ground traumatic encephalopathy, the traumatic brain injuries, to its impact on the game. As far as what we've heard, either behind the scenes or off the record, I know John Mara, the owner of the New York Giants, called it the most critical question facing the NFL today. One of the things that was established in the week leading up to the meeting is the concussions went up 58% in 2015 after they seemed to be slowing, leveling off, and possibly even declining a little bit. They went from, I believe it was 207 concussions in 2014 to 271, I believe, in 2015. So that really concerns a lot of folks when they worry about the safety of the game. There's a lot of talk about making the game safer, and yet, here we go. Again, John Harbaugh has claimed that eliminating the cut block is going to make it more dangerous. It depends on really who you talk to, And so the other thing that I think there has been a fair amount of discussion with down here is that people are forgetting that CTE, chronic traumatic encephalopathy, still does not pass any reasonable test by medical science standards. The reason that Jeff Miller, the senior VP in charge of health and safety, in the roundtable held at the U.S. House last week, acknowledged it is because you can't hide from it anymore. And one of the researchers at Boston University, this Dr. Anna McKee, has studied the brains of 94 players and found 90 to have some level of CTE, but it's being pointed out by many doctors around the country that has nothing to do with the cause. You've got the effect, but there's no proof that it was caused by playing football. There's no comparing it to Alzheimer's patients. There's no knowing how Alzheimer's patients got Alzheimer's. The reality is CTE is something that still cannot be determined or diagnosed until after death, until you can take slices of the brain. And so while the league is very concerned about it, it's also important to point out that there's just a ton of research to do here and a lot of knowledge, and you're starting to hear some medical people from around the country come out and say, listen, everybody knows that multiple concussions can't be good for you. But as far as saying that playing football causes CTE, the medical community is nowhere near ready to say that. And that's where the league starts to get into trouble relative to expanded liability to its players, and that's where the financial health of the game can go south. But the belief is from the medical people, not so much from the NFL people, that they're just not close to that yet.
Yeah, I think we could definitely talk in circles about CTE for pretty much an entire podcast. Hub, I did want to ask a question a little bit of a lighter note. I'm just kind of curious if you can give us kind of a feel. How do these owners' meetings work as far as when you get to talk to different coaches? I mean, how open are these coaches with you? And kind of what are the different personalities that you get to see in this kind of setting with the coaches we kind of know around the league?
Yeah, well, Nate, there's actually 28 of the 32 coaches I believe there's 31 of the 32 coaches here. Andy Reid is having a knee replacement, so he is not in Boca Raton. Of the 31 coaches here, there were three who failed to show for the team picture, so to speak. It's become a tradition that every year they take a picture. I'm trying to remember who the three were now. I know one of them was Bill Belichick. That'll surprise nobody. Although he did show up for the picture last year, so it was a little disappointing this year. At any rate, though, the picture isn't important. What's nice about it is that you get to see all these guys in a relaxed atmosphere. It's not game day. They're not working. They're not practicing. Many of them are here with their families, and so the communication there is a little bit better. When you do get into the formal press conference settings, it's not all that different, except that there's really no questions that are out of bounds. You can go anywhere you want with these guys. It is every coach having, if you will, a Super Bowl experience. They're used to just dealing with their local media. Now all of a sudden they're dealing with about 300 credentialed reporters here. Just to put that in perspective, at the Super Bowl there's 4,000 credentialed reporters. At the Combine there was 1,200. There's 300 here. So it's obviously less than 10% of what they see at the Super Bowl, but nonetheless it's an unusual experience. for many of them to have to answer questions from reporters all over the country. So you can get some good insight. I'm just working up now some of the stuff I got from Gus Bradley, and it's really interesting, to hear him, a defensive coordinator, talk about how he's building his team to compete this year around the offense and changes that they've made. So we'll have that at ProFootballWeekly.com in just a little while. And then, where you get into the kind of backing off, not getting much information, not even getting answers, is when you start to ask about specific players. Nobody wants to do that. It's a waste of time to ask questions about the draft. Nobody's going to share any of that with you. Interestingly enough, there are no coaches I've run into who have a problem with free agency or the silly money that's being spent. They say that this is what their players work for. They say it's frustrating at times. Gary Kubiak said today, when I asked him about Malik Jackson getting $42 million guaranteed dollars, he said, "Hey, I'm not going to comment on whether he's worth it or not. I couldn't be happier for the guy. I only had my 1 year with him, but he was a great guy to have around." He said the frustrating part is that he clearly emerged this year, particularly the second half of the season, and we get that half a season, and then we have to say goodbye to him because we just don't have the cap space. And I think what he was indicating is that some coaches feel that, free agency punishes the better teams more than the weaker teams. But, guys, that was the whole idea, to create competitive balance, to spread the wealth. It's one of the things that makes the NFL as competitive and as enjoyable as it is. So it's a great environment to get to know coaches and general managers. You do get more access, more information than you get at any other event. But at the end of the day, we've seen the trend in the league. They're trying to turn it into a little CIA operation. And so a lot of teams still holding it very close to the vest.
Why am I not surprised, Hub, that you were the one asking the Malik Jackson question? You've been kind of outspoken about the former Bronco turned Jaguar. I'm kidding, of course. I know of the roughly 300 media members that are down there. No one's busier than you are, Hub. So we do appreciate the time. We're going to cut you loose. But as you provided a good teaser, all of our listeners should be heading to ProFootballWeekly.com. Hub has all kinds of columns. And make sure you're checking out Hub on Twitter as well, because he is very active there too, @Hub_Arkish. Hub, we appreciate your time. We'll talk to you soon.
Just to follow up, though, I was actually following up on a Malik Jackson.
Okay.
I didn't bring it up.
All right. Appreciate that.
No, listen, I don't care. I did ask, but it's a great event. It's gotten us a lot of new information, and good to talk to you guys. Enjoy the rest of your time on the cast.
All right. Thanks again, Hub. We'll talk to you soon. That was Hub Arkish, our fearless leader at ProFootballWeekly.com. He is doing great work down from the owners' meetings. We hope you are following it all on ProFootballWeekly.com. Got us up to speed on a little bit of the rule changes. We do have a full list of the 7 that have been approved so far. But he did kind of do a really good job of hitting on the big ones. And Nate and I figured we'd have a little bit of fun now. We had a story in the past couple days about the rule changes we wish that teams had proposed. So we're going to lay out a few of those for you. And then we're going to talk about a few of our couple free agent periods. So we're first going to take a very quick break. But coming up on the Pro Football Weekly podcast, as I mentioned, all kinds of great free agency insight, a little bit more rule changes discussion, that and more when we return. Welcome back to the Pro Football Weekly podcast. We are pleased you can be with us. I am joined by my co-host, Nate Atkins. You can find him on Twitter at Nate Atkins CF. You can find me on Twitter at Arthur Arkish. And Nate, some good stuff there from Hub, but we thought we'd have a little bit of fun now regarding the rule changes that we wish teams had proposed. You can check that out on our website as well, just kind of a fun column. I'll throw it to you first. Is there one or two that stand out, rule changes that you wish teams had proposed that likely would have not been approved?
Yeah, this was a little fun piece we did, a great idea by John Solly, our online guy here at Pro Football Weekly. But he came up with one that I really, really liked from the that we wish the 49ers had proposed. It's to count every Michigan loss as a San Francisco win. You know, just a little dig at Jim Harbaugh there. I think they'd actually love that if it was actually a rule there.
They read my mind.
That was your favorite.
That was one of the ones I had here as well. Very good, clever stuff from John. Actually, there's another one from John Sally. I liked it as well. It's the Miami Dolphins one. Allow for an off-season championship banner ceremony. no one is more deserving than Stephen Ross in recent years. So another good one from Sally. I'll throw one more in your direction. The Falcons had more than a couple run-ins with their assistant coaching staff, frankly, going wild down at the Combine last month. I said it'd be pretty funny if there was no penalties for hits by an assistant coach of the Falcons, Brian Cox, one guy who got in hot water for getting into a shoving match with the Cardinals, a Cardinals scout, I believe it was. So we have serious stuff, but also some lighthearted stuff at the website. We hope you're checking it out. Nate, switching gears a little bit, we also did another analysis piece of, well, we gave grades to all 32 NFL teams after the first wave of free agency. I thought it'd be fun to just go over maybe one that you really liked, one that you didn't like in terms of free agency activity with teams. You handled the AFC, so I'll throw it to you first.
Yeah, well, if we're talking ones we really liked, I was blown away, and we've talked about this before, but I was blown away by the Chiefs' moves in free agency. And it's disappointing today the news comes out that Justin Houston might miss the entire season with some ACL complications. But as far as everything they've handled this offseason, I don't know how they could have done it much better. You know, you thought this was almost going to be like a mini version of what the Broncos were going through, where they make a playoff run and then these expiring contracts hit and they're all going to leave. But almost everyone they wanted back came back, and mostly on defense, guys like, you know, if that's Jay Howard or Tom Bahaly, or they franchise tagged Derek Berry. They got Derek Johnson back, and they got him at pretty good costs. I mean, outside of the top five salary for Berry, and yet they still managed to go out and get a big addition to their biggest weakness on offense, which was pass protection for Alex Smith, getting Mitchell Schwartz from Cleveland.
Right.
And what I love about that move is that they're able to move Eric Fisher over to right tackle if they want to, and he might be more comfortable there. And you just kind of have some bookends for once, some potential bookends. If we're talking ones we didn't like, I mean, this is – we brought this up a couple weeks ago, but I think the Browns just completely whiffed in free agency because they essentially did nothing. And it's not that free agency, you have to go out there and spend, and that's not that's the answer, and at least they didn't take on one of those contracts. But you've got to re-sign the good players you've developed who want to stay with you at their value or below. And they had a couple of those at least in Mitchell Schwartz, who I just mentioned. They had a deal potentially on the table with him that they pulled off and kind of let him go. And Tayshaun Gibson was asking for a contract for 2 years from them, and that's a 25-year-old who had 13 picks in 3 years. And that's, you know, becoming a very premier position in the NFL, and they wanted to just let that walk. And it isn't just that they didn't want to splurge in free agency. It's that they apparently had no plan. We can't tell what their plan was, and reports out there from kind of their interactions with agents is that they didn't seem real confident in negotiations. They weren't really sure what they were after. And it really kind of feeds to the notion that these analytics guys they brought in are a little in over their heads so far. So those are the ones that stuck out to me. I know you did the NFC. What kind of jumped out to you on both ends?
Yeah, speaking of no plan, you know, I feel like Cleveland has certainly caught a ton of flack, and all of it has been, you know, with merit. But I don't think the 49ers have been a whole lot better. Very, very quiet. That's what I believe a 5-11 football team, 4-12 football team. They were terrible last year. Of course, they had the house cleaning and brought in Chip Kelly, took away his personnel control he had in Philly. I'm wondering if maybe Chip Kelly needs a little bit more personnel control. They've really haven't signed anyone. They've lost so far Alex Boone. That surprises no one. But the offensive line is really what made that team, a big part of what made that team so successful for a number of years, and it has completely fallen apart. Doesn't look like Anquan Boldin is going to be back. And the one re-signing they made that I felt they could feel good about, Ian Williams, who originally got 5 years and $25 million. Now we find out he's had a couple ankle surgeries, and it's become a one-year deal. So, and then, of course, Colin Kaepernick is still just kind of twisting in the wind. So not real positive for the 49ers. And did I not mention they have the most cap space in football? So it's one thing to try and build your entire roster that way. I'll never be an advocate of that, but it looks like San Francisco has been a little bit too quiet. They could be in store for a pretty rough year in year one of the Chip Kelly regime. One quick positive one, then we're going to bring in Kevin Fishbane, and I'm going to the NFC North here. Well, I'll go to the NFC North in a minute with Kevin Fishbane, our Bears expert. I actually like what the Tampa Bay Buccaneers did on the positive side. I gave them a B+. Getting Robert Ayers and Brent Grimes, I thought, was just a terrific really foresight what they needed for that pass defense, one of the worst in football last year. And then Daryl Smith, I know he's 34 years old, but I have kind of a soft spot for Daryl Smith. I think he's going to come in, play that Sam linebacker spot next to Quan Alexander and Levante David. I see so much improvement with that defense, and I thought the offense at least was getting close, with Jameis Winston obviously bringing back Doug Martin to being ready to compete. So I've talked a lot about how the Eagles and Howie Roseman have taken back their team in the post-Chip Kelly era. I think you could argue that Jason Light has done the same thing in the post-Livy Smith era. It's been pretty impressive for the Tampa Bay Bucks. On that note, Mr. Fishbane, Kevin, the Bears are getting a lot of accolades for what they have accomplished thus far in free agency, and we all know that Super Bowls are won in the month of March. So have they scheduled the Bears Super Bowl ceremony yet?
There is one for the 1985 Bears coming up. 31st anniversary this year. Very exciting stuff. You know, Jim McMahon, that defense, 36 years. It's going to be a lot. Nice studio you guys have here for Pro Football Weekly podcast.
It's nice of you to say.
You know, better than the Chicago football one?
Yeah, you know, it's a little different, but, you know, we're not, we're all teammates here. No, Bears had a good March. You know, I'm hesitate because I always think back to 2014 when they had clear needs of pass rusher. They add Lamar Houston and Willie Young. They brought back Cutler and Jennings and Slauson and Robbie Gould, and everyone was excited. I think it's obviously a lot of things happened to that team that why it's fell apart. This is much different, but, you know, you needed inside linebackers. You got Dan Trevathan, Jarrell Freeman. Done. You have your two starters. They're good players. Trevathan's young. Freeman's, you know, got that good experience from Indianapolis. You needed an offensive lineman. You get to move Kyle Long back to right guard because you got Bobby Massey. You need a defensive lineman. You got Akeem Hicks, and you can still draft a defensive end, which I think they should do at 11. So it's hard to ask for a better – oh, and all the guys they re-signed. They re-signed 9 guys. So including Alshon Jeffrey and Tracy Porter, who were their probably top targets. So I know how you two feel about the Matt Forte situation. We haven't really talked about Martellus Bennett. But it's hard for me to see – with everything we knew, how the Bears could have had a better free agency.
I'm glad you mentioned Martellus Bennett because we didn't tape last week when that trade occurred. Just your thoughts on both Martellus and, of course, Shea McClellan heading to Foxborough for their reinvention under Bill Belichick. How do you think Ryan Pace made out in the deal with Bennett? And do you think Shea McClellan can kind of revive his career with New England?
Oh, yeah. If he could do it with anybody. Of course, the Patriots wanted him in the 2012 draft.
Yeah.
And, you know, he got a lot of money there, too, which is really impressive. Good for him. Always a hard worker. He had to play 3 positions in 4 years with 3 different coaching staffs.
Right.
Again, not taking any blame away from him for not being productive, but it's something to – can I plug the Chicago Football Podcast on here?
I would hope you will do
that. You know, with this week – last week we had Pat Manley on talking about these signings, and this week my guest was Tom Fornelli of CBS Sports talking about the Shea McClellan and Martellus Bennett decisions. So folks can get a little more details there, but – everyone in the league knew that the Bears wanted to trade Martellus Bennett, and they still got a 4th-round pick for him. So I think that in itself is impressive. You can have your own opinion about whether or not look, they're a worse football team without Bennett. They're a worse football team without Matt Forte. There's no question about that. But this is what John Fox and Ryan Pace wanted. When your coach and GM make a decision, they want to make a move. You know, the Bears fans have no reason to distrust Ryan Pace at this juncture, or John Fox. So you got to kind of – they're asking for a lot of trust, I think, when they do these things. But I don't know how much they care about the trust of the fans. They care about what team they want Halas on. That's what they're building.
Yeah, and talking about the team that Ryan Pace wants, and that's why I go back to Matt Forte and what Arthur and I have argued about that, is it just seemed like they were, to me, it seemed like they were outsmarting themselves with that, where you have a good player who wants to come back for cheap. He ended up signing 4 years and $12 million with the Jets, and they just let that walk from a 6-10 team. But what I'm curious about is what their plan is to replace Forte, because now you have Jeremy Langford, who's obviously an up-and-coming player, but not sure he's a full-time guy. And your backup, though, is Kadeem Carey. And I don't know that any of us are convinced, watching him take handoffs at the one-yard line, that he's a number two back who can come in and handle all the responsibilities. With all that said, it makes me wonder, do you think, is there a plan that they have as far as the draft goes? that could be where they're looking for running back. And maybe it was a plan all along that we let Forte go, we look to the draft, not in free agency, and we try to go there. You think that's a possibility?
Well, I think when you put that much faith in a fourth-round pick, two fourth-round picks, that tells me what you think about the position and what you think you can get out of it. And then you throw a lot of money at C.J. Anderson, which really threw a lot of people for a loop. And Ryan Pace said today, you know, things happen, and good player was presented to us. I, without talking to Ryan Pace or John Fox, it wasn't stumbling that they looked and saw, wow, C.J. Anderson got an original round tender in Denver. You know, he's only, 25? And look what he did last year, and look what he could do in John Fox's offense. Why not take a run at him? I think it's very different than Matt Forte, that situation. But it still kind of confused me, because I've said all along, it makes no sense to draft Ezekiel Elliott at 11 if you're not going to spend the money on Matt Forte or C.J. Anderson. Why would you spend a premium pick on Ezekiel Elliott? But now, what if they think Ezekiel Elliott's that good? Certainly he'll rub a lot of Bears fans, I think. Well, I shouldn't say that. Bears fans will be very conflicted, because I think some Bears fans will be so excited about an electric player like Ezekiel Elliott, but your Forte fans will be, well, wait a second, why did you not re-sign Forte, but then you spend the 11th pick? I would imagine they might still add another running back in free agency. There's still some veterans out there just to get a body, but I could see a 4th, 5th, 6th round pick entering the mix as well.
Just a little dot connecting for those who maybe don't know. Stan Drayton, the Bears running backs coach, is Ezekiel Elliott's former position coach at Ohio State. I think he's a very real possibility at 11. If he's the best player on their board, I think that's what Pace will do. But how big would this young GM Stones be to go offensive skill position player in the top 10 2 years in a row with all the needs on defense? That would really be something else. And then just backtracking quickly, and we're running out of time, so we're going to wrap it up in a second. But is it fair then, because you said we're kind of dwelling on Forte, I know we are a little bit, absolutely Bears fans are going to be comparing the production of Langford, Carey, and whoever else comes in versus Matt Forte, but if the Bears offer that kind of money for Anderson, is it also fair to compare the production of those two next season to see, you know, just to kind of have an idea of what the Bears' vision may have been, even though it wasn't executed?
There are still Bears fans that compare every time Chandler Jones gets a sack and point out the fact that Bears picked Shane McClellan to pick before him. So obviously everyone's going to look at that. I think folks look at, you know, that's just the way that you look at things. And when you decide to not re-sign Matt Forte, it's a business decision. And I don't, you know, I don't personally don't care either way what the Bears decided, but I understand where they're coming from. You have the organizational philosophy. You're not going to pay a 30-year-old running back, whether it's Matt Forte or anybody else. It's what you have to stick with, and they clearly knew all along that's what they were going to do. So it's going to be a comparison thing, but look, you mentioned they have these needs on defense. Their defense is better now than it was on January 1st. Their offense is worse now than it was on January 1st.
Yeah, that's a great point.
So while their defense might still have more needs, because you have Pro Bowl caliber players in Kyle Long and Matt Slauson and Alshon Jeffrey and maybe Kevin White and maybe even Jay Cutler on the offensive side of the ball, you have more of those than you do on defense, your offense is the unit that has taken a step back this offseason. So that could be an argument to take an Ezekiel Elliott at 11.
Yeah. That's an interesting point. I hadn't thought about that. Nate?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it is interesting to think about it that way, that they made some nice moves. I mean, getting a fourth-round pick out of Martellus Bennett, but the production you lose there, I mean, I know they brought back Zach Miller. I mean, what do you envision his – I know we're running out of time here, but what do you envision his role being this year? Does he step into that full-time role with Martellus Bennett gone, or is he still a guy that they're going to try and combine a little bit with another tight end and where would they go to get that, do you think?
I think he'll be what we saw the last five games of the year. Last year with Bennett out, he'll be the pass-catching guy. They need and want to find another player. They're going to go get another tight end to be kind of that blocking tight end. But, look, if you're comfortable with Zach Miller being your pass-catching guy and they're paying him that way, having a need for a number two tight end is not really that big of a deal in the grand scheme of things. Of course, Zach Miller is not as good as Martellus Bennett, but you can find a better number two tight end than what Zach Miller was last year in terms of the role he had. So they'll find a way to make it work. And, you know, look, in Chicago, we talk about this with Tom Thibodeau and the Bulls. Sometimes it doesn't make sense, but you got to do what's best for the organization, that what you feel at that time. You got to continue to move forward, even if it doesn't make your team any better necessarily.
That's Kevin Fishbane. He chased Matt Forte out of town, folks. I'm kidding. That's Kevin Fishbane, @KFishbane on Twitter. We appreciate him coming on and talking a little bit of Bears. That's going to do it for this week. We realize as a podcast, we actually really have all the time we want, but we want to make sure we're keeping your interest level up. So why don't you come back next week? We are going to shift gears. We're about to go draft heavy for the next 4 or 5 weeks leading up to the draft. We're going to be bringing on guests, giving you all our rankings you can find in our draft magazine. So please come back. We appreciate you being here this time. For Nate, for Kevin, I am Arthur Arkish. It has been a great pleasure, and until next time, take care.